106.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Welcome to a new season of The Parent Show, here on Mix 92.6. We hope you all had a good summer break. First off tonight, we're revisiting our series on girls in STEM, and Vivian met up with Michelle McDowell, MBE, to discuss how she got into engineering, her career, and the achievements that she has had.
Welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Vivian Glass, and we're here with Michelle McDowell, MBE, who's talking to me today for our STEM feature, or Science, Technology, Engineering and Maths, to break down that acronym. At The Parents Show, we've been talking to female guests who specialise in these fields about their journeys and perhaps inspiring some young girls or women to consider careers in industries that still remain quite male-dominated. But that may be changing. Michelle, you're a real success story in the structural engineering world as a fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering, the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Awards twice for women in construction and engineering, and the president of the Association for Consultancy and Engineering, the first, I believe, in its history, which spans over a century. Welcome to The Parents Show, Michelle.
Thank you, Vivian. Delighted to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you, Michelle, and I'd love to know if you could just tell us a little bit about what is it you do in the structural engineering world today?
Okay, well, in the last 38 years, actually, I've spent designing buildings, whether it's hospitals, schools and offices. I ended up on the board of a large practice of architects and engineers, running their engineering group. And then about 2 years ago, I decided to leave that position and for a more flexible lifestyle. So I'm now a non-executive director in an engineering company. What that involves is attending board meetings, advising, mentoring, just basically bringing the benefit of my experience.
Oh, fantastic. Michelle, you mentioned quite a wide variety of different sort of projects. Have you got some particular career highlights or your favourite projects that you could share with us?
Well, certainly in terms of projects, the two that stick out in my mind are the restoration of the Houses of Parliament, which I worked on for the last 8 years in my career. It was a wonderful project to work on. I felt very proud and actually honoured to be part of that project. And the other one is the redevelopment of the Royal Albert Hall, which was basically excavating a basement adjacent to the hall and 33 refurbishment projects inside the hall to make it fit for the 21st century.
These are really prestigious projects, Michelle. It's fantastic. How did you start on this journey? Tell us a little bit about how you started into this career in engineering.
Okay. Interestingly, I was at an all-girls school and the careers advice didn't cover engineering at all. And I was lucky, my dad was a science teacher and came home with a leaflet from the Construction Industry Training Board for a residential course for girls doing maths and physics at A level. So I travelled from Northern Ireland, where I was at school, to Sheffield for, I think it was about a week. We visited a design studio, a steel blast furnace and a construction site. And suddenly everything gelled. Because up to that point, I didn't know what an engineer was, what they did. But I realised that it was for me. It was that practical application of maths and physics, really.
So that was obviously, you were kind of at A-level, a real key junction point in anybody's choice making, I suppose. You mentioned that it wasn't really fed through to that careers options as a girls' school. Do you think that, you know, being female in this industry, has that helped your career or has it hindered it at any points?
Well, it's a bit of both. I mean, in a minority, and I certainly was when I embarked on my career, on my university course even, you are in a minority. So you do stand out, and whether you're in a design studio or a construction site. So you're easily remembered. People remember your name and people perhaps take notice of you. But sometimes I would say, you know, it's hard to feel you belong when the chit-chat's perhaps about, you know, football or, you know, things that perhaps you're not so interested in. And it can be a little bit lonely, particularly at senior levels when you're most definitely usually the only female.
So your dad obviously recognised your particular talents and your interests and encouraged that. But do you think that other men throughout your career, you know, maybe your male peers, have they been supportive or have you sometimes experienced negative attitudes?
Yeah, again, a bit of both. I've had some brilliant male mentors who supported me as my career's developed, and that's been brilliant. And they've recognised my skills. But I've had, you know, some difficult times too. You know, a male engineer who refused to work in a team I was leading because I was a woman. So really, you've just got to deal with these things and move on. For me, that was his problem, not mine. So you have to be quite strong and deal with it.
And is it something, I mean, you've mentioned the loneliness aspect there. Has that always been quite apparent to you that women are underrepresented in this industry? Or do you think as you've travelled, it's more in the senior roles, perhaps? How does it sort of play out?
Yes, it's getting much better. So when I embarked on engineering career, it was very, very unusual. But now I would say that quite often at graduate level in a company, it can be 50-50, male and females, but you do tend to find it peters out at senior levels for a number of reasons, I guess. So some barriers persist, but it's definitely getting better, but it's too slow as far as I'm concerned.
What could change that, Michelle? What could speed it up?
There are a number of things that could be done. Employers could perhaps be a little bit more flexible in their approach to engineering, could also recognise broader skills that women tend to bring. So, you know, there are a number of ways. And I think mentoring or women's networks can also help women feel that they belong and they can share problems with their peers, female peers, and, you know, have the confidence to progress.
On that side of things, on the part around the strengths or the particular skills that women might bring, is there elements that you feel you bring that are really important that have carried you through some of the more challenging moments?
I don't know if it's my Northern Ireland upbringing, but what someone once described me as having a sort of steely determination, and I think that's carried me through my career. But, you know, I'd be keen to emphasise that you don't need to be like that to succeed. There are all different sorts of skills you can have, whether it's creative skills, people skills, technical skills, they all count. So you don't need to be like me to succeed. And I think those skills are more widely recognised now.
Michelle, I'm right, I think, in saying that you also are a mother and you probably bring some of the skills perhaps that you've picked up along the way in parenthood. Has parenthood helped you, or do you think it's been more difficult?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think although there are obviously more demands on my time from my two boys, I think the skills you develop as a mum and bring to the workplace are really so valuable. You know, the multitasking, the negotiating skills, time management, decision making, empathy, all those skills really, I think, can make you into a very strong, compassionate leader, really. And they're not always evident in the workplace. So I think you can bring a new dimension, and which is very valuable.
Something I've noticed when I'm reading, you know, when I'm reading pieces that are from leadership roles, is that there seems to be a tendency these days to draw a little bit more on vulnerability and actually make that actually something that's acceptable, that makes people more relatable as well. Do you think that's an important part at the moment of being a good leader?
Yes, absolutely. I think you need to be strong in certain circumstances, but you also need that empathy. And what I found actually in leading sort of large multidisciplinary teams, if you do have that empathy and you talk to all the different people, different levels in the team, people respond and you actually get more from them and they're more engaged. They stay the course through difficult times. And, you know, they're more dedicated. So I really think it's a valuable approach to leadership. Yeah.
And perhaps we've got among our listeners some mums who might be returning to work. Mm-hmm. Maybe those in particular who might be coming back into quite male dominated industries. Yeah. Is there any advice that you have for them? that you could offer?
Most certainly. I mean, I think transparency is the key. So have a think about what arrangements you need or would work for you on your return to work, and talk it through with your employer and come to a really clear agreement about what works for you both. And also perhaps, you know, what would work if you have to deal with emergency or you're suddenly called away. Because then that gives you the confidence to know that you can leave at 4 o'clock if you need to for school pickup. You won't feel guilty. And if some unreconstructed colleague makes a comment, you can be absolutely clear that, you know, you're doing the right thing. So I would absolutely recommend having that clear agreement that works for you both. I would also say, you know, be flexible with your employer. When you first return to work, it's a moment in time and the demands are extremely high on you. But as your children get older, you know, the demands change. So it's a moment in time when you need those arrangements, but they can adapt as you progress.
That's really insightful and great advice, Michelle. And then looking at our other listeners, perhaps we have some young women who are listening. If you could give some words of inspiration or maybe encouragement to yourself, to the young Michelle at that point when you were, you know, going to that camp, that week away, that residential, what would you say to her now?
Okay, well, it's interesting because I went into it blind. I really didn't know what I was doing. But for me now, with my experience, I mean, engineering is really at the heart of everything we do, from, you know, sport, fashion, you know, construction, computing, medicine, everything we do has engineering at the heart. So I would say if you really want to make a positive impact and help solve, you know, the problems that we're facing in the world, whether it's global warming, whatever, I think engineering is a really good way to do it. It's creative, it's technical. You work with people from all different backgrounds, whether it's the construction worker on site or the client, you know, government bodies, architects, you know, the opportunity to travel as well. So, you know, there's no more rewarding career as far as I'm concerned.
You're a great advocate for it, Michelle. When we were talking earlier and we talked a little bit about that sort of, I suppose, that transformational moment when you thought the light bulb went on and you thought, this is what I want. That was your dad who sort of promoted that, who gave you that leaflet. Do you think that mums and dads have different perspectives when they're talking to their children about future careers? And how do you think, I suppose, if you mentioned you've got two sons, but if you had a daughter, how do you think mums and dads can kind of encourage those perhaps unusual choices that aren't necessarily the obvious paths to follow, but might be the right one for their child?
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on the individual as far as mums and dads' perspectives are concerned and what their backgrounds are. So really, I think it depends on the individual. But in terms of, you know, how parents can help their daughters, I would really encourage them to encourage their daughters to be bold, because I see so many highly talented women who lack confidence. They're better than their male peers in a lot of circumstances, but they're too shy to speak up and they get left behind. So encourage that sort of boldness or confidence. And I would also say encourage them to be themselves rather than trying to adapt to be what they think an engineer should be. So that will create a challenge, which leads to innovation. And that's a very valuable thing in engineering. So they should be themselves as well.
So do you think that that's part of why engineering has been such a man's world? Because it's been created by men for men in some ways, and actually bringing a female perspective to it and different skill sets, different perspectives, you know, why has it been such a male-dominated industry to date?
Well, I think traditionally you needed to be studying science, maths to be an engineer, and traditionally boys pursued those subjects and girls pursued perhaps softer subjects. Obviously, things are changing now. But also, I think the industry hasn't really done itself too many favours. You know, many girls, you know, can't relate to the image of an engineer, which is traditionally a man in a high-vis jacket on site with muddy boots. You know, what connection can you make to that? So the industry hasn't always been welcoming to women, but I think, you know, the Royal Academy of Engineering has many campaigns now, and it really shows what women can bring to engineering. It shows the diversity of what's on offer there. So it's changing for sure.
Just with you talking about the construction sites, are there some practical things there? I mean, have you ever turned up and, you know, if you had to be on site, found things like the PPE, you know, personal protective equipment that just isn't in your size, or things that are just very practical things that, that people might not always consider when they're working on that?
When I was younger, I worked on site for a year and a half on the construction of a new office building. And there were no female toilets. So I had to get someone, you know, when I had to go to the loo, I had to get someone to stand outside the male toilet. You know, so it doesn't really make you feel you belong. Yeah, so it's quite difficult from that perspective, yeah.
And do you think that, you know, women really, or do you think girls really need to see women represented to encourage them to go forward? You obviously, you came out and you stepped into this industry, as you said, quite blind. And possibly naivety can sometimes, I think, be a benefit when you're pursuing a new path. But do you think if actually there is more visibility and more representation, that that's a really valuable part of encouraging more girls?
Absolutely, yes. I think with women in the more senior positions in a company, the younger girls can see, you know, career routes. Gives them a sense of belonging as well. They know there are other people in this situation. So I think it's absolutely vital. But, you know, I didn't have that when I started, and I found male mentors who were able to do the same thing for me. So if there aren't other women around who can support you, you'll find amenable men who will do as well.
And what should we be telling our boys? You know, what advice can we give our young men about how they can support female peers, whether that be in school or in the workplace, and sort of maybe break down some of these gender barriers that have existed around certain industries?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I see it so often in meetings where women start to say something and, you know, they're spoken over. So my advice would be listen to and give a voice to women in the team, you know, and there are techniques for doing that in a meeting rather than let the loudest voice speak first. You know, perhaps you could do an around the table so everybody gets a chance to speak. And I would also say, you know, judge people on their contribution, not their gender. So what they're doing, what they're contributing. And that would be the other advice. Just, you know, be inclusive. That's all. That would be my plea.
That's a fantastic plea. And do you think that this can really, we've seen such a big shift already, but do you think we'll get to a place where, you know, you might look up at a building site and see 50-50, where you might, you know, you might go into any senior engineering firm and, you know, you meet one of the partners, you can expect to see women at these senior levels and all the way through the industry? Is that something we can expect? And if so, how long do you think it'll take to get there?
That's my dream. It's already happening in some companies. So there are some leading the way. I mean, the company where I'm a non-exec director has a very good representation, an unusually good representation of women, even at senior levels. It's not 50-50 yet across the board, but it's getting there. So yeah, I would say, I think it'll take a while, but with more women coming through and with employers realizing there's a skills shortage and that they need to be adaptable in the sort of employment contracts they're offering, I think it will gain momentum, but I think it'll be quite a few years before we see the 50-50.
Michelle, it's been super to speak to you. One thing I haven't asked you about, which I must, is your MBE. That's such a huge accolade. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. So, yes, it came out of the blue, actually. I just got a letter through the post. I thought it was from the tax office, but I opened it and it just said, would you be willing to accept an MBE for services to the construction industry if it were to be offered? So I did say yes. I think it came about through my sort of working with the Association for Consulting Engineers and the Institution of Civil Engineers. So that sort of broader contribution. It was an absolute delight to take my parents and husband to Buckingham Palace. And we were delighted that on the day it was the Queen giving out the awards. So had a little chat with her. And yeah, it's just like the ultimate school prize giving. It was wonderful.
Oh, that's such a sweet way and such a modest way to describe it, Michelle. It has been absolutely our honour to listen to you today. And thank you for telling us all about your career, giving us some real insights into those key moments and some brilliant advice about practical things that mums returning to work can do, that girls can do, and that we can encourage our boys to think about as we move through some really big changes, I think, in industry and in how we view different job roles and different careers. So I really appreciate you joining us, Michelle.
It's been an absolute delight. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Thanks, Michelle.
A big thank you to Michelle for talking about her career in the construction industry. Now, Mixed Morning's Ellie met up with Zara from a new group called Drama Tots, exploring drama and music and play for under 3-year-olds. Ellie started by asking Zara what Drama Tots is all about.
So it's really wonderful. It's created by Leanne Jones in 2016, and it's absolutely amazing. It follows the early years curriculum, so everything we do will help with speech and language, communication, learning, all those sorts of wonderful things. And you come to my class, we'll sing songs, and we go on an adventure that comes out of my suitcase. And that adventure is different every single week. My house is now full of props.
Oh, but it is, yeah.
Full of different things. And it's so brilliant. We do drama games, we do singing, we do dancing. And I wouldn't say I was the best singer in the world. Not even close. No one's going to be.
No one. Do we need to? We're not trying to, you know, be the greatest singers.
No, but we just want to have fun. So
don't we just want to have the joy of singing?
That's it.
So, and I think one of those things is it doesn't matter how you sing. It's just sing, and that releases those endorphins, and it just makes you happy, isn't it?
That's exactly it. Yeah.
So, we're talking about Drama Tots, brand new in Hertfordshire.
Yeah.
Which is very exciting. And Freya, who is your daughter, who, as her own mother described her, a bit dramatic, which we love, and she can channel her energy, can't she into
can.
Drama Tots with all that high energy and singing and your props. But it's good for kids who don't have much confidence as well, isn't it? Because it will bring kids out of their shell.
Absolutely. And we provide like a really nurturing environment. We make sure that there's no pressure. You know, you don't have to join in that moment. You know, you can watch other children maybe joining in. And it's all about being inclusive. We want to include every child that comes into the room. It doesn't matter if you want to sing, dance, stand up, or if you want to just sit down with your mummy or your daddy. You know, it doesn't, for us, it's just all about including everyone, I think, and that's the most important thing.
And I think that's infectious, isn't it? Because we were just chatting before, in between, while Andy Bell was singing Don't You Know, and I watched the Freddie Flintoff documentary, and he's kind of got these kids from deprived background and building cricket teams with them. Yeah. And one of them, so he's got a group of girls as well, and it's interesting because he has worked with boys' teams before, and it's a completely different ball game working with girls, but they're all literally arguing, and you know, one girl hates another girl and they keep storming off, and he takes them off to build a raft and by the end of it they're all loving it, you know, like they've all patched up and all of that. So it's about inclusive. They were like going, no, we need everybody here to do this.
That's it.
And that's really important. So the songs you sing, I'm not going to make you sing on air.
Thank you. You can see the look on my face.
but no one else can, but I could. But the songs that you sing, are they part of Drama Tots, or do you find them? Are they kind of well-known children's songs?
So we do a mix. So we've got the well-known children's songs sometimes, but we've got lots of original music. So Leanne's got an educational music producer, and they produce these songs, and they're absolutely incredible. So we've got lots and lots of original songs. And then we've got some classics as well, like Raindrops Keep Falling on Our Head, those sorts of ones, for some bubbles and things like that. So it's a complete mix.
Oh, I like the sound of that. Yeah, the raindrops.
Stuff for grown-ups.
Blowing bubbles. And that song, that is genius, yeah,
it's really
have to
lovely.
Say.
And because it calms the children down, because obviously they love bubbles, but when that song's on and it's really, it's a magical
moment. Do they do actions as well? So not, you know, like moves, yeah. So raindrops, do they?
Yeah, so we can do, and sometimes we'll let them just free play with them, but yeah, sometimes we'll do the actions with them and encourage them to sort of move around.
I'm so excited about this. I just want to join in, quite frankly.
I want you to join in.
So, first class.
First class tomorrow.
Is when? Tomorrow. Yes. What time?
So we're on at 9:45 at Trestle Art Space.
Trestle Art Space, okay, in St Albans. It is beautiful.
It's got a lovely cafe and things there, so it's really, really nice.
And is it full up, the space?
No, we're not full yet.
So you could still book.
Few spaces actually remaining.
What's the age group?
So it's 18 months to 5 years is our classes.
Yeah.
So yeah, and then we do drama club, which is 5 to 7 years, but those are usually in schools.
Okay.
But yeah, the community classes are 18 months to 5 years.
And how do people get in touch if they wanted a book? Someone wanted to go, I quite fancy that. Why wouldn't you?
Yes.
I fancy it. I have no child connected to me. I might just loiter outside Trestle looking in and
hear.
So how do people get in touch, Zara?
So you can get in touch with me on social media. So it's on Dramatot St Albans and Harpenden is what I am on Instagram and Facebook. So you can get in touch with me there, and my booking link's all on there. Or if you just Google Dramatots and go onto the website and click St Albans, all the information and the booking is on there as well.
So why wouldn't you? Just for singing bubbles, you know what I mean? Raindrops keep falling on your head. What is there a sneak preview of what's lined up for tomorrow? Are you all prepared?
You've got
your props?
We are going on, I'll give it away, but we're going on a circus adventure tomorrow. So that's really exciting. Loads of fantastic props. We'll be doing balancing. The children are going to be pretending to be lions, jumping through hoops.
Oh, gosh. I'm like thinking star. Nelly the elephant. I'm already.
There will be elephant song.
See? This is fabulous.
Yeah, so we cover it all.
Okay. So if you do want to get in touch with Zara, check her out on Facebook, on Instagram. I had a look at the website yesterday. Anyways, dead easy. I literally Googled Dramatots, St Albans and Harpenden. Do Dramatots. It comes up, it says, where do you want to look at?
Yeah.
Trestle Art Space. What days are they going to be going forward?
So Wednesday morning we'll be at Trestle Art Space. Thursday morning we'll be at Harpenden Trust Halls in South Down, which is a gorgeous venue. They've got a lovely cafe run by volunteers, and it's a donation only. So you have a cup of tea and a cake and you just donate.
Wow.
And it's all handmade cakes. It's just the best. And Thursday afternoon, I'll be at St. Stephen's Church, which is just off the King Harry roundabouts.
So perfect. Honestly, literally, why wouldn't you? Wednesday and Thursdays are the days that you can get involved, get your little one off to Dramatots. And perhaps, you know, who knows, that could be a budding acting career.
Yes, stars of the making.
So just before you go, because we were chatting about it, and I know it's a future thing, but it's nice to have your ideas about the intergenerational stuff. So just tell us what your ideas are, and then, because I think it's such a beautiful thing to even be thinking of, and your enthusiasm is amazing for it.
I just love the idea of it being across all generations. I think it's just amazing. And the lovely Leanne has set up a world in which we can set up these intergenerational sessions. And I'm so excited. So yeah, hopefully we can get classes going. I'm going to start that maybe a little further down the line, just to get myself comfortable with it all.
Yeah, no, I know, but I just, but the thought of it, I think
keep,
is lovely.
Keep your eyes peeled for that. Hopefully in the new year or the start of maybe the summer term, but we want to create those sessions.
Well, you'll come back and tell us all about it.
I absolutely will.
Wish you the very, very best of luck, Zara.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in and talking to us about it. And
thank you.
If you do want to know, please get in touch. with Zara, Drama Tots. Check her out on Instagram, on Facebook. She's there, and Google Drama Tots and you'll find her, St Albans and Harpenden.
Zara Gooder from Drama Tots was talking to Mix Morning's Ellie there. You can find out more by going to dramatots.co.uk. We're going to take a quick break now on The Parents Show, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Today I'm really thrilled to be joined by two of our semi-regular guests on The Parents Show, Lena Gardner and Binny Figura from Raiden Solicitors, right here in St Albans, but across Hertfordshire, actually.
And they are, of course, sponsors of The Parents Show, we are delighted to say.
Lena and Binny, welcome to The Parents Show and thanks for joining us in the studio.
Hi, Lydia. Thanks for having us.
Now, Lena, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and then Binny? I'm going to put you on the spot.
So I'm Lena Gardner. I'm a partner and collaborative solicitor based in the team in St Albans. I work for Raiden Solicitors. We're a specialist family law firm. So family law is all that we do. And we deal with the whole spectrum of family law issues, including divorce, separation, disagreements about child arrangements, prenuptial agreements, and more.
Thank you, Lydia and Lena. Yeah, I echo what Lena says. I'm an associate solicitor based in our St Albans department, and I became a collaborative lawyer in November last year.
Now, for any of our listeners who don't know what collaborative law is, Lena, can you spell it out for us?
Absolutely. So collaborative law is a unique process that a couple can use to work through their family law issues. Most usually that would be if a couple is going through a divorce, but it's not always limited to a divorce. It could be used if a couple wanted to enter into a prenuptial agreement or something like that. And the whole ethos of collaborative law is to stay away from court proceedings and to stay away from an adversarial process. So it's about working together to resolve the issues without the need to go to court or to have an adversarial process that can often, you know, turn up the temperature and make things even more difficult. So it's a very constructive approach.
I think that's probably music to the ears of all our listeners, because confrontation, conflict, that's words everybody wants to avoid at all costs. So that's great. That's great news. And so how, Binny, if I can ask you, how does it differ from going to court or even mediation? Some of our listeners might be familiar with mediation.
So as Lena quite rightly said, it's about a process which avoids court. The main ethos kind of behind collaborative law is that the parties retain that control. When you are in the court system, you have a judge making the final decision. But a good point with collaborative law, the whole process, is that those that are involved are leading those discussions. It is usually a quicker and cheaper option than court proceedings. If you do have to go to court, you are following directions and a timetable that the court imposes, whereas within the collaborative process, you can timetable that according to your own needs. And ultimately, the people involved are making the final decision as opposed to a judge in a courtroom. With mediation, which is equally helpful, it is another form of alternative dispute resolution, as is collaborative law. The ultimate difference is that each party will have a collaborative lawyer. In mediation, you will have a neutral mediator that will sit between you and try and assist. But with collaborative law, you will both have a collaborative lawyer who is giving their client advice, whereas mediation, it does it as such. It is a more formal process than mediation. And ultimately, if you do reach an agreement, you can formalise that in collaborative law. Whereas in mediation, if you do reach an agreement, that has to then be formulated into a final court order.
That's really clear. Thanks so much for explaining that. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I could imagine people having a preference for having their own representative rather than one person who represents both parties or kind of mediates between both parties. Like, it's so great that the nuance, like that there's so much preference going into helping families negotiate tricky territory like divorce. It's really heartening to see that solutions are popping up to cater to really every option.
Absolutely. I think, as Binny said, mediation is a really great process in its own right, but it's a very, very different one because there's one neutral mediator and that can feel quite daunting. Whereas with collaborative law, you have your lawyer with you all the time. So within the process, you're always going to feel supported. And like you've got your solicitor by your side, which is a big difference to mediation.
Yeah, no, it sounds personally, I think that would be my preferred route. It just feels like it would be more supportive. And then you can have conversations outside as well with somebody who is just tailored to you, to your cause, I suppose. And if someone chooses collaborative law, can you tell us what the process looks like, Lena?
Absolutely. So the first thing to be aware of with collaborative law is that you do need to identify a solicitor who is experienced in this area and who has the collaborative training under their belt, which Binny and I both do. So that's an important point to note. At the outset of the process, if you and your collaborative solicitor feel that the process is the right one, and the other person involved also is happy to go ahead with the collaborative process, then fundamentally what will happen is there will be a series of meetings between the two people and the two collaborative solicitors. So we call them four-way meetings. And it is really as simple as that. So there will be a series of these four-way meetings. They'll be spaced apart, probably a few weeks in between each meeting. And really, the meetings will be where the discussions happen and where the agreements can ultimately take place. Now, at the beginning of the process, it's really important to note that everybody involved will sign a commitment to not go to court, to keep the case out of court. And if the process breaks down, then the parties would have to find new solicitors. So what that means is that there's a really strong buy-in to the process from the beginning. So everybody is fully committed to resolving the issues within the collaborative process. So it's the four-way meetings that are the key element to the process.
That's a brilliant idea. And it sounds so constructive, you know, putting those kind of assurances in place to make sure everybody keeps on track is fantastic. And Beanie, I could imagine our listeners thinking, do lawyers really work together, even though like they come from opposite perspectives? How do they bring the best interests of both parties together?
Yes, it's a very good question. I think that's a lot of listeners will have that that question in the back of their mind. And yes, lawyers are trained to work together. There are clear boundaries in place. When you are looking at collaborative law, even the lawyers involved in that know that from our training, it's all about being cooperative, problem solving, and supporting both parties, because you are engaging in a process where you want your clients not to have to go to court. You want to sit around these round table meetings and solve their issues. So you can work together. You do have clear brands. And as Lena said, you have these meetings together where if there are issues that crop up and you see that your client and the other party are going to disagree, the solicitors, the lawyers will get together and see what way you can tackle to overcome those issues, as opposed to it breaking down and then one going off to court.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, in a collaborative case that I dealt with not so long ago, one of the people involved was finding the process challenging, because obviously, you know, we were talking about really difficult issues to do with the arrangements for the children and the finances and how things were going to pan out after the divorce. And she was finding it quite overwhelming at times. And myself and the collaborative solicitor on the other side, we really were able to work together to make sure that the process was as smooth as possible for everybody. So we made sure that there were lots of breaks when, you know, when everybody just needed to take a breath and get some fresh air. We made sure that the meetings didn't go on for too long. So we tried to keep things sort of bite-sized. So we were able to work together in that way to make it as comfortable a process as possible for our respective clients. And that worked really well.
That's incredibly reassuring.
Yeah, and it takes out the delay. So as opposed to writing a letter, sending it to the other side, you could have those conversations together. And so I think clients would appreciate that, because there's points that don't have to be dealt with by correspondence, and you can actually sit down and just tackle through them together.
That's fantastic. Really reassuring. And is there anybody else who could be involved? Like, is it really just the four people, or can anybody else be brought into the conversation?
Yeah, so often there could be professionals such as family coaches, pension experts, mortgage brokers, even barristers can get involved. So that's, you know, that's another advantage of having that. And again, you're sat in a room together. There is no pressure of court proceedings. And you've got these experts that are giving you, are able to advise you. There are situations where children will be involved. And because of the breakdown of the marriage, the children are suffering as a result. And you can have therapists that come in and assist in those scenarios as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very holistic process, really, because you know, we're looking at the situation from all angles, making sure that we're involving the right people for the right issues. And as Binny said, that might be more financial experts, like financial advisors or mortgage experts, but equally it could be, you know, professionals that are able to offer more emotional support to the family, like therapists, coaches, and those kind of people. So it's very, very tailor-made to the individual needs of the family.
Yeah. And I love that everybody you're mentioning who could potentially be brought in, it feels and it sounds like it's about constructive solutions rather than slinging mud at each other or kind of trying to build a case. It everything sounds neutral and constructive and helpful to the parties. And it feels like it's going, you know, in a positive direction.
Absolutely. Yes, that's right. I mean, it's one of the great advantages to the process, really, is that it's focused on the needs of the family as a whole, rather than, you know, it becoming an argument and a battle between the two people.
A lot of couples, when the marriage or relationship does break down, I think they automatically think, I'm going to end up in court, which a lot of people don't want to do, or they're in a situation where they think they can speak to someone and work through those issues. They just need a professional. So this is the type of process that would really benefit them.
Yeah, it's really compelling. And actually, it feels a bit silly asking the next question because I think I know the answer, but I'd love to hear it from you both. Like, so why do people choose this route instead of the usual court battle? You must see so many different types of scenarios.
Yeah, we do. I mean, I think where the situation lends itself to the process, so where people really want to work it out themselves, it's a great process because it is so constructive. It can be so much quicker because, as Binny said earlier, the people involved, the clients involved, have control over the process. So they're setting the agenda, they're setting the timetable, rather than being in the hands of the court process, which is, you know, really slow, unfortunately. So much quicker. Saving time usually means saving money as well. So it can be significantly less expensive than the court process. But for me, the main advantage is it's keeping the channels of communication open, and it's keeping the family on amicable terms, especially where there are children involved. It's really important in my mind that everybody does what they can to keep things as constructive as possible. And that's where the process really comes into its own.
Yes, completely agree with Lena on all those points.
Brilliant. And I mean, it's so nice and refreshing to kind of buck every stereotype about divorce ending up in court and being acrimonious and adversarial. And you paint such a constructive and harmonious picture. Obviously, it's not going to be harmonious all the time, but every kind of accommodation is made to keep it going in that direction, it feels, from what you've described.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And are there times when it just doesn't work? Are there times when actually collaborative law isn't the best option and you just can't choose that route.
Yes, there are certain situations. I mean, collaborative law is based on openness, trust and commitment to the process. And if there are situations where one party isn't being completely honest or just doesn't want to be, it just won't work, and the process will fall away. So it has to be both parties committed to the process. But if there are situations where there are safeguarding concerns for children, say, or domestic abuse, it's probably not going to be the right process. But having said that, collaborative lawyers, we are trained to be able to assist. So even if we do face difficult situations, we can try and work through that. But if there is a huge area of concern to a party, then it won't work. There has to be that commitment from both parts.
That makes sense. And I wonder, do you ever come across a situation where a couple might try collaborative law, and for the reasons that you describe, Binny, it kind of breaks down, they head down the court route, realise the mistake that they've made, and come back to collaborative law with a little bit of a more kind of bigger commitment to make it work?
I think more often than not, what would probably happen in that circumstance is that they would reach an agreement at some point alongside the court process. So, you know, that's often what we see when a couple is involved in court proceedings, whether they've tried collaborative law first or not, is it's quite rare that the case goes all the way to a final hearing or what we might call a trial, because there are opportunities along the way for settlement to be reached. So that's probably the likely scenario in that instance, rather than circling back to the collaborative process again. It's not outside the realms of possibility, but I would say more often than not, the case would settle at some point along the court process without having to go all the way to a final hearing, which is when the costs really start to mount up. It's quite stressful because evidence has to be given and cross-examination and all of these things. So most cases don't get that far.
Great. Thanks a lot for that. So it must be tricky enough still keeping everything on a friendly basis or a kind of harmonious basis, particularly when you're talking about big issues. I think you touched on a few of them. Finance is always a big issue. Children and time with your child is also probably one of the more contentious issues. How do you keep things on track?
I think it's quite, you do need to focus the clients in the meetings, that they will have differing views. For instance, when we talk about finances and fairness, not everyone thinks what they've got is fair, that they will have those views. And also, when there are children involved, you may have a parent that thinks that actually they're better off spending more time with one parent than the other. So it is just working through just to get to reach a solution that works for both of them. But the process isn't entirely smooth in that sense, because you will have those rocky parts through it. But it's about sitting down together with your lawyer, who's your opponent, and seeing whether you can reach a solution which works for everyone.
The other thing I would add to that as well is at the beginning of the process, the couple can choose to sign anchor statements, which basically set out the reasons why they're committing to the collaborative process. And at any stage in the process, we can come back to the anchor statements, reread and review the anchor statements, and remind everybody there why we're doing this process and what the benefits of this process are and what everybody's hope is and what everybody's vision is. And that can often help us guide our clients through the really tricky bits of the process, as Binny said.
Even if your emotions do get high, I suppose, in that situation, again, like Lena said, with the anchor statement, it's about having that there, because it just reminds them that's why they started it in the first place, and they haven't gone down the court route.
That's a lovely idea, to bring it back to the good intentions that were set out right at the beginning. So
exactly.
Yeah, really nice. So do you think the kind of, or you must see, is collaborative law getting more and more popular? Are you finding an uptick in demand for it? Is word spreading about it?
So the family procedure rules changed as of April 2024. The court expects parties to explore alternative dispute resolution before they make any applications to court. Mediation and collaborative law are forms of alternative dispute resolution. So there is an emphasis on people looking at other ways to deal with their issues. As I certainly, since becoming a collaborative lawyer, offer it to my clients when they come and see me at the first meeting. And there is, because they know that there is a way to avoid court, they're more willing to engage in that. So there is definitely an increase, there are more and more lawyers now becoming collaborative lawyers than probably there have been in the past. And so hopefully it's onwards and upwards, and you'll hear more collaborative success stories.
Absolutely. And Binny and I are both members of collaborative pods. So a collaborative pod is basically a group of collaborative professionals who meet regularly to discuss ideas, to talk over different experiences, share ideas, share knowledge, undertake training, make sure our skills are up to date, etc. And we're all, you know, very passionate about the collaborative process. So that enables us to work together on cases and to, you know, refer work between ourselves to try and spread the word about the process and open it up to as many couples as possible.
Yeah, brilliant. And it's great to get the opportunity to spread the word through the Parents Show, so that just to raise awareness of it, because it sounds so much more constructive than other options. And where do you see the approach heading in the future? Are there any big shifts in the law planned that might facilitate it, make it even easier, or what's on the horizon?
I mean, we now have no fault divorce. So that's definitely made a big difference, because divorce is no longer a blame game. And we've had the change in the rules about court becoming even more of a last resort. So the things are moving in a direction where collaborative law is becoming, you know, more well known, and the benefits are even more important than ever. So Binny and I certainly hope that as time goes by, more and more people will choose this process over others, especially as the court system unfortunately becomes, you know, more and more burdened, really, in terms of the number of cases and the delays and the costs. So we really hope to continue seeing an uptake in the collaborative process, certainly in St Albans and the surrounds, which is our local area. So we will see as time goes on.
Yeah, and I'm sure Lena will agree, but we're very well happy to speak to anyone that has any questions about collaborative law and the process, just to give them some more insight into it.
Brilliant. Binny, Lena, thanks so much for joining us on the Parents Show and sharing your expertise. Like, it's just really refreshing. Thanks a million.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raydon Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raydonsolicitors.co.uk.